Well, many thanks, President Olting von Gisow, for that very warm welcome, and Professor Kelly for that very gracious and generous introduction. And thank you for inviting me to this esteemed institute, something I've wanted to do for quite some time. I bring greetings from my colleagues within the Center for Catholic Studies at Durham University, and I'm delighted that our two institutions are exploring how we might work together for mutual benefit in service of the mission of the Church in theological research, education, and formation. Last week, as President von Gisow has mentioned, we were honoured by your visit and two very fine lectures. And just last week, Dr. Vincent De Mayo, who I've yet had the pleasure to meet, very good to meet you, I'm afraid I was away on Bishop's Conference business, honoured us with a very fine lecture last week. So it is good to make a return visit. The International Theological Institute, the ITI, is a beacon of excellence in Catholic theological education and formation, a fitting tribute to the theological vision and courageous ecclesial leadership of your founding Grand Chancellor, His Eminence Cardinal Christoph Schönborn. We in Durham are very much, for our part, hoping that His Eminence will be able to accept our invitation to present our Bishop Dunn Memorial Lecture in November 2015. In the meantime, it gives me great pleasure to be able to dedicate this lecture this evening in honour of His Eminence. In this season of celebrations for the 50th anniversary of Vatican II, almost 50 years to the day since the promulgation of its decree on ecumenism, Unitatis Redintegratio Gratia, I've been asked to speak on the Catholic ecumenical vision at work in a fresh strategy for contemporary ecumenical engagement that we've pioneered at Durham, and which over the past decade has attracted considerable international attention in both academic and ecclesial contexts, including within the Pontifical Council for the Promotion of Christian Unity. We've been calling this approach receptive ecumenism, and developed and presented as an explicit formal strategy, there is certainly something of a freshness about receptive ecumenism. But that said, and as needs acknowledging, and as we'll see this evening, viewed in another way, it's also to some degree what William James would refer to as but a new name for some old ways of thinking. We always stand on the shoulders of giants. Receptive ecumenism seeks to take two apparently contradictory things equally seriously. First, clear recognition as to the reality and challenges of the contemporary ecumenical moment, wherein the hope for structural unification in the short to medium term is now widely recognised as being unrealistic. But second, equally clear recognition as to the abiding need for the Christian churches precisely in this changed situation to find an appropriate means of continuing to walk the way of conversion towards more visible structural and sacramental unity. As such, seeking to hold these two apparently contradictory aims together, or contradictory concerns together, the central aim of receptive ecumenism, we might say, is to seek after an appropriate ecumenical ethic and strategy, both ethic and strategy, for living between the times, for living now oriented upon the promise and calling to being made one in the Trinitarian life of God. And in service of this aim, receptive ecumenism represents a remarkably simple but far-reaching strategy, which draws out the dispositions of self-critical hospitality, humble learning, and ongoing conversion that have always been quietly essential in all good ecumenical encounter, and seeks to place these now at centre stage as an explicit strategy or organising principle for contemporary ecumenism. The conviction is basically that considerable further progress is indeed possible, despite appearances, but only if each of the traditions, both singly and jointly, makes a clear programmatic shift from wishing that others could be more like themselves, a natural enough inclination, it has to be acknowledged, to instead asking what they can and must learn themselves with dynamic integrity from their respective others. Now, the conviction is that this receptive ecumenical mode of proceeding is of relevance for all of the traditions. But having said that, it's notable that receptive ecumenism has come to explicit articulation precisely in a Catholic context. And there's no coincidence here. For as this evening's lecture is concerned to argue, receptive ecumenism has deep roots in and resonance with an authentically Catholic understanding and practice of ecumenism. The lecture is accordingly in four parts. First, I reflect on what it means for us to commemorate Vatican II. Second, I'll review some of the key insights at work in Unitatis Redintegratio, noting as we do how they were later reinforced and developed by Blessed Pope John Paul II. Third, I'll explore the theological vision and strategic intent of receptive ecumenism, again noting clear precedent in and resonance with John Paul II's ecumenical teaching. And finally, I will further underline this authentic Catholicity of receptive ecumenism by noting similar clear accord with the respective ecumenical teaching, both of Cardinal Joseph Ratzinger, whilst prefect of the Congregation for the Doctrine of Faith, and most clearly now with that of His Holiness Pope Francis. In short, the argument of this evening's lecture is that which has been long incubated within the ecumenical movement has now come of age and needs to be given its rein and put to work for, firstly, the flourishing of Catholicism's own Catholicity, with that, the furtherance of the common ecumenical pilgrimage, and in turn, the quality, integrity, and appeal of the Church's witnessing to the world. So that's the four parts of the menu. For those who wish only to engage certain parts, press snooze control and float in and out. And you've got a handout which can keep you entertained during those periods. So to take the first section on celebrating Vatican II well, remembrance and anticipation. What does it mean for us to celebrate the 50th anniversary of Vatican II? For those who lived through it, it was the defining Catholic experience of their lives. Whether it needs to be acknowledged through enthusiastic embrace or through aggrieved reaction. For enthusiasts, this act of remembering can have something of mourning and protest about it. Mourning for a perceived eclipsing of the great work of Vatican II, and protest that things should be otherwise. For others, however, making memory is an act of necessary reinterpretation, of seeking to reclaim the council from what they regard as distorting and dangerous novelty. Here, caught between this polarity, Pope Benedict's careful balancing of the language of reform and continuity in relation to the council is significant, and reminds us that the duality of continuity and change is properly of the essence of Christian tradition, which genuinely is the dynamism and fidelity of the Spirit in the Church. Dynamism and fidelity. Well, if we can ask the general question as to what it means to celebrate Vatican II, all the more so can we ask this of Unitatis Redemptor Gratiae. What does it mean at this point in church history to be celebrating one of the defining impulses to the ecumenical story? For some, it represents all that was right about the council. For others, all that was wrong. For the enthusiasts, Vatican II opened the golden age of modern ecumenism, marked by what now seems to have been the overly optimistic expectation that it would be possible within a generation to overcome all the historic divisions between the traditions and so achieve a structurally and sacramentally united church as an actual possibility. The great bilateral dialogues were established to serve that very goal, and for quite some time, all the indications seemed remarkably positive. Take the Anglican Roman Catholic International Commission, ARCIC as it's known by its acronym, and also the Catholic Lutheran dialogues as examples. Through a combination of clarifying misunderstandings, drawing on recent scholarship for fresh perspective, and viewing differing theological frameworks as potentially complementary rather than necessarily opposed, one historic point of division after another seemed to render itself as no longer necessarily communion dividing. In contrast, however, ours are difficult times for formal institutional ecumenism. Not only have some of the classical issues around authority and decision-making proven more intractable than imagined, new issues have arisen, at the formal level at least, concerning significantly different views in relation to such things as women's ordination and the pastoral care of people of homosexual orientation. Such real differences at the formal level do not lend themselves to being explained away, as the classical bilateral strategies would typically do, as legitimately diverse ways of articulating the same basic position. As a consequence, there is widespread energy drain around formal ecumenism and a sense of frustrated disappointment among its enthusiasts. The wave of ecumenical optimism flowing from Vatican II appears beached, its energy spent. What does it mean that the bark of the church is passing through such challenging waters? How is it that this, quoting Lumen Gentium 1, that this sacrament of intimate union with God and of the unity of the whole human race, how is it that it's not of one mind?
never mind one body. Well, in part at least, it perhaps simply means that the church is a living, breathing, organic reality, and not simply an ideal on a page. Disagreement, difficulty, and tension are normal in the experience of the church, as also in society. Grace, the movement of the Spirit in the life of the church, is not about the eradication of difficulty and the achievement of an easy uniformity, but about the church being held, even deepened in communion, in and through such differences and difficulties. Viewed in this way, the bark of the church is rightly in midstream. Neither the starting point nor the conclusion of its own story, but in its midst, both remembering and anticipating the one who is Alpha and Omega, Emmanuel, God with us, is remembering us and drawing us into the fullness of communion. The fourth gospel has a wonderful pair of narratives in chapters 6 and 21, which bring this home. The first, about Jesus coming to the disciples on the lake in troubled conditions. The second, about the disciples coming to shore to find the risen Jesus already there, preparing breakfast. Christ, the one in and through whom all was called into being. This Christ has already passed over through disappointment, even death, and is the one who always already awaits us, calling us forth. Remembering well in relation to Unitatis Redintegratio is about a calling forwards as well as recalling backwards. So moving now to the second section of the lecture on the Catholic ecumenical significance of Vatican II. Sorry, perhaps I should also add a coda to explain the nature of the handout, for those of you who are wondering why it doesn't follow the structure of the lecture, because it doesn't. The handout is a kind of resource for further thinking. The first page gives you a basic statement of what receptive ecumenism is about, the kind of thing I started by saying. Then you've got a longer section which has various key principles at work in receptive ecumenism, which if you want to float through now, do so, or leave to another time. And then you have a basic bibliography. So I just saw that some people were trying to work out where section two was. It's not there. Okay. So the second section of the lecture on the Catholic ecumenical significance of Vatican II. Now, whilst dichotomous contrasts between pre-conciliar and post-conciliar Catholicism can be unhelpfully overplayed, in the case of Catholic ecumenical teaching, it's right to remind ourselves of the contrast. Not contradiction, but contrast. In the face of the rise of the modern ecumenical movement, which in its origins was a Protestant affair, the 1917 Code of Canon Law had forbade Catholics from participating in meetings with other Christians, let alone from sharing in their rituals. As articulated most clearly in Pope Pius XI's 1928 encyclical Mortalium Animus, otherwise known as On Fostering Religious Union, the mindset was that the one true Church of Christ is to be straightforwardly and exclusively identified with the Catholic Church, and that therefore any such association with other Christians would suggest a false equivalence. The only way forward, it was thought, was that of unidirectional return to Rome. Now, when set in that perspective, the contrast both of tone and indeed of content could not be clearer when compared with Unitatis Redintegratio, and Lumen Gentium. Relinquishing the attitude of one-sided fault, Catholicism's own complicity in the breaks of the 16th century is acknowledged in section 3. And recognition given that, quote, very many of the significant elements and endowments which together give life to the Church can exist outside the visible boundaries of the Catholic Church, again, section 3. And the implication is drawn in that same section, quote, to the extent that these elements are found in other Christian communities, the one Church of Christ is effectively present in them. Furthermore, these ecclesial elements are regarded as being of significance for the Catholic Church itself, and not simply for the status of the other traditions. Most pointedly so, it's recognised that some of these ecclesial elements may, this is remarkable, may have come to fuller flower in the other traditions than they've been able so to do within Catholicism. And now I quote from section 4, whatever is truly Christian can always bring a deeper realisation of the mystery of Christ and the Church. John Paul II later underlined this in very certain terms in his remarkable 1995 encyclical on ecumenism, Ut Unum Sint, referring to other Christian communities as places, quote, where certain features of the Christian mystery have at times been more effectively emphasised, end of quote. This is a point that he stressed even more clearly in a personal capacity in Crossing the Threshold of Hope, where we find him speculating that for all the implication of human sin in ecclesial divisions, and for all the need for these divisions to be reconciled, they may nevertheless have been allowed for in the providence of God, precisely so that the characteristic gifts and charisms of the various traditions might each come to clearer prominence than historically they were able to do in the undivided Church. And indeed, writing around this time also, Joseph Ratzinger makes a very similar point. These lines of understanding combine in Unitatis Redintegratio and Lumen Gentium with an emphasis on Catholicism's own need to learn, to be renewed, purified, and even reformed. For example, Unitatis Redintegratio 6 speaks of ecumenism as a renewal, renovatio, and a, quote, continual reformation, perennis reformation. And similarly, Lumen Gentium 8 speaks of the Church as being in a state of semper purificanda, of always being purified. Now, for sure, communion with the Bishop of Rome continues here to be viewed as an essential aspect of the unity of the Church, a core gift of Catholicism, if you like, such that, as the famous subsistit in clause of Lumen Gentium 8 articulates, all the essential elements of the Church of Christ can be uniquely claimed to be present together in the Catholic Church. Nevertheless, even whilst maintaining in altered mode that traditional Catholic claim, nevertheless, this is quite clearly no longer ecumenism conceived simply as a call to one-sided return, but of growth on both sides and mutual journeying to a new relationship. The implication is that communion with the Bishop of Rome is one thing, but communion with the Bishop of Rome as currently structured within Catholicism might be quite another. As Unitatis Redintegratio 4 puts it, quote, there, by which they mean Catholics, primary duty is to make a careful and honest appraisal of whatever needs to be done or renewed in the Catholic household itself. End of quote. This Vatican II call to put one's own house in order resonates strongly with one of the central themes of the current papacy. So let us turn now to ask what it means in this winter of ecumenical discontent for us to seek to live into Vatican II's ecumenical vision. So the third section of the paper, Receptive Ecumenism in Service of Vatican II's Catholic Ecumenical Vision. As already noted, in contrast to the heady days following Vatican II, ours are difficult times for formal institutional ecumenism, by which I mean the kind of ecumenism that still aims at working towards full reconciled communion. Many have grown impatient and have downsized the ecumenical goal to seeking simply to get along and do as many good things together as possible. Prayer and tea parties. Or if you like, life and works ecumenism instead of faith and order ecumenism, rather than as a necessary correlate to each other. But the point is that while such things as shared prayer and witness are as crucial to ecumenism as oxygen is to life, no matter how much getting along with each other and doing good things together we have, they alone are never going to solve the ecumenical problem, which in Catholic understanding is to do with the broken sign value we give of our communion in diversity in the Trinitarian life of God. For this, the aspiration of formal institutional ecumenism remains basic, whether we like it or not, and however difficult it might seem. And that's the problem, because it is this very aspiration which each of our last three popes has told us is non-negotiable. It's this very aspiration which is now so difficult to pursue, it would seem, in any meaningful way, at least as far as we have thus far done. So in this apparent cul-de-sac that we find ourselves in, we need to remind ourselves of some basics. First, is that the Spirit of Jesus Christ can be trusted not to drive us into blind corners in order to prod us with a stick. If the call to full structural and sacramental communion really is a gospel imperative, as we're being told in Catholic teaching it is, if it's a constant, then so also will the Lord's resourcing of the churches to live this imperative be constant. The context and the challenges it entails might be different. Previous strategies and resources might no longer be adequate, at least at this juncture. But fresh strategies and resources there most surely will be. Our task, as such, is to discern them and to live them with courage, creativity, and fidelity. A second basic that we need to remind ourselves is that unlike optimism, authentic Christian hope is not a form of reality denial. Christian hope, as Pope Francis reminds us in Evangelii Gaudium, takes reality in all its starkness radically seriously, even into and through disappointment and death. Knowing that our role is not to be the architects and sole producers of a future that is not yet, but to be its servants. That our role is to anticipate this now but not yet future, of which we can get glimpse and foretaste, and to ask ourselves what it means to live it in the present, what it means for us to be conformed to that which we glimpse and taste so that we can grow more fully into it. What it means for us to, if you like, lean into the presence of the Spirit, who is this sure foretaste and down payment, so that we can be held, set on our feet, impelled to action, called to conversion, and made living witnesses to this future in the here and now, in ways that will both take us towards it and inspire others also so to travel. A few minutes ago, I was suggesting that Unitatis Redintegratio's central contribution was to present Catholic ecumenical learning, as distinct from teaching, as a means whereby Catholicism could itself hear the call to continuing conversion and renewal, and so grow more fully into what Catholicism most deeply already is. In Ut Unum Sint, John Paul II again gives us a remarkable witness to this reversal by extending an invitation to theologians and leaders of other Christian traditions to help reimagine the way in which the papacy itself operates, so that it might once again become the focus for Christian unity rather than the continuing cause of division it currently is. Here we have, I suggest, clear prophetic expression of the imaginative commitment to the continuing conversion of one's own tradition that is now required if the Christian churches really are to progress beyond friendship to the full catholicity of the one Church of Christ. And as for individuals, so also for institutions, the fact is that it can take time for us to grow into living in accordance with our deepest insights. And more generally, it's this basic Vatican II-inspired ecumenical approach of focusing on one's own tradition's need for conversion, which in recent years has been formally developed and explicitly offered as a fresh strategy and way for contemporary ecumenism under the title of receptive ecumenism. Unlike much contemporary ecumenical practice, receptive ecumenism does not foreclose the traditional faith and order concern to work for the structural and sacramental unity of the churches and then settle for something less. Rather, in tune with Catholic teaching, receptive ecumenism maintains the abiding importance of this goal and seeks to serve it constructively whilst also taking the change challenges absolutely seriously. At the heart of receptive ecumenism is the basic conviction that further substantial progress is possible, but only if a fundamental counter-instinctual move is made away from traditions wishing that others could be more like themselves, to instead each asking what they can and must learn with dynamic integrity from their respective others. And that twin phrase, dynamic integrity, is important in each of its parts. Integrity, authenticity, and appropriate dynamism. There is, if you like, for those who recognise the reference, a John F. Kennedy-style reversal at work. Ask not what your ecumenical others must learn from you. Ask rather what you must learn from your ecumenical others. This required ecclesial learning is envisaged as operating not only in relation to the easy things such as hymnody, spirituality, and devotional practices, but as extending to the hard things, to doctrinal self-understanding, and even more so, respective structural and organisational cultural realities in the traditions. As such, receptive ecumenism can be viewed as taking the evangelical call to growth and conversion and applying it to the institutional, structural, and formal ecclesial dimensions of Christian existence, and not just, as is more commonly the case, the individual and personal dimensions. In this perspective, each tradition is called to take responsibility for its own required learning, rather than to wait on others to do likewise. And to take this responsibility in the first instance for the sake of its own greater flourishing. The basic principle at work in saying that, for the sake of its own greater flourishing, is to recognise that for all the many particular gifts and strengths that are to be found in each tradition, each also variously falls short of the glory of God. Each has specific characteristic difficulties and limitations, open wounds, if you like, in need of healing. Difficulties, wounds that can be highly resistant to resolution from within a tradition's existing resources. Indeed, seeking to resolve such long-term difficulties using existing internal resources alone is somewhat like a hamster running on a wheel in its cage. There might be a real sense of movement, but no real progress forwards is actually being made. On the contrary, the harder one pushes, the more the existing logic is simply being reinforced. There's need for refreshment and renewal from without, from the best discernible practice, alternative logics, and ecclesial experiences of other traditions. As this suggests, this has the prospect of being a dynamic process that will take each tradition to new places. In the first instance, for their own health and flourishing, but in such fashion as will also potentially open up fresh possibilities currently unforeseeable for their relating to each other. Of course, the general tendency is somewhat different to this. The general tendency is to seek to hide such wounds, to live in denial of them, to hide them particularly from those outside the family circle. Consequently, far too much ecumenical engagement is really a matter of what in England we would refer to as getting the best China tea service out, of showing ourselves in the best possible light to our distant relatives, perhaps even semi-estranged relatives, who are coming to visit, rather than allowing the more warts and all self-understanding that we keep locked behind the closed doors of the intimate family space to come into view. Rather than the ecumenism of the best China, receptive ecumenism represents an ecumenism of the wounded hands, of being prepared to show our wounds to each other, knowing that we cannot heal or save ourselves. That's a Christological reference, of course. Knowing that we need to be ministered to in our need from another's gift and grace. And trusting that as in the risen Lord, in whose ecclesial body these wounds exist, they can become sites of our redemption, jewels of transformed ecclesial existence. By so doing, receptive ecumenism forsakes the aspiration for a programmed step-by-step journey to a foreseeable destination and embraces instead a less defined but more fundamental program of conversion that will take each tradition to a fresh place wherein new things become possible. New places, moreover, and this is important, that involve each tradition becoming more fully, more freely, what it is, and what it most deeply already is, rather than becoming less of what it currently is. In other words, this is not lowest common denominator ecumenism, This is about becoming more Catholic, more richly Catholic, not less so. In terms of what all this might mean in practice, it's highly significant that the third major phase of the Anglican Roman Catholic International Commission, inspiringly referred to as Archic 3, as though it was the third in a series of Hollywood blockbusters, lacking the gripping narrative, unfortunately. It's significant that Archic 3 has explicitly embraced receptive ecumenism as a key facet of its methodology. It's significant also that Archic 3 has been tasked not with easy issues, but precisely with engaging such difficult issues as authority and decision-making at local and universal levels of the Church. A key example of where Anglicanism and Catholicism have real substantive difference and not just apparent difference. For the Roman Catholic, I should also say, examples of where Roman Catholicism and Anglicanism not only have real substantive difference, but also each have real differing but real tensions within their respective communions. It's significant that for the Roman Catholic members of the Commission, this will involve exploring how matters such as papacy, collegiality, ecclesial subsidiarity, and lay participation in decision-making, all issues we have been hearing intoned by Pope Francis, can each be appropriately renewed, reformed, and expanded in service of a fuller and deeper Catholicity through appropriate learning from Anglicanism. And in turn, as to what Anglicanism equally might have to learn from Catholicism, well, that's for Anglican members to ask and for the Catholic members to be prepared to support as desired and required. Now, in proceeding in this way, Archic 3 is making no claim to being able finally to overcome in any programmed way the deep meta-differences in decision-making structures and processes between Roman Catholicism and Anglicanism. That would be utterly unrealistic, certainly in the foreseeable future. What it is seeking to do, however, is to focus honestly on respective difficulties within the traditions as these arise in the lived experience of the concrete Church, and to make some kind of progress, albeit more modest than might have once been hoped for. The important thing is, however, that this is being done in the conviction that any such progress and change within each of the traditions will in turn open up significant fresh possibilities for working towards reconciliation between the traditions, by each tradition learning something from the other. Now, whilst this will never result in the two traditions appearing identical, and nor should it, that's not what Catholicity is, they might each grow to becoming more recognisable to each other in a familial kind of way, whilst also retaining their distinctive personality traits resituated. By so doing, they might each even arrive at a place of recognising themselves in the other in themselves, and as each being bound together in the fullness of Christ and the Spirit. So let me turn now to the final, shortest, concluding section, the timeliness of receptive ecumenism in the context of the two most recent papacies. If we were on an aeroplane, I'd now be saying, can the crew please take their seats ready for landing? The undercarriage is coming down. Okay. So, starting out with reflections on what it means to celebrate well the 50th anniversary of Vatican II, this lecture has focused on uncovering the Catholic roots of receptive ecumenism and presenting it in all its radicalness and all its challenge as an authentically Catholic calling. This claim can be underlined, and the timeliness of receptive ecumenism emphasised further by indicating the further significant resonance with both the long-term ecumenical thinking of the then Cardinal Joseph Ratzinger and the freshly emphasized teaching of the now Pope Francis. For all the significant differences of style and tone between the two most recent papacies, differences between, if you like, prudence and parrhesia, between a concern for integrity and an openness to self-criticism, between a call for active trust in God's providence and an emphasis on the urgency of response to the call of God in the specifics of time and place. For all these differences of tone and emphasis, there is nevertheless deep complementarity between their respective ecumenical visions, as there is also with that at work in receptive ecumenism. But of course, this is hardly surprising, given that each is variously shaped in accordance with the fresh springs of Vatican II. Most significant here for present purposes in Joseph Ratzinger's writings, and also perhaps most surprising, is his emphasis in his 1986 open letter of a certain sort, to the editor of the Tübinger Theologische Quartalschrift, on the need to, quote, accept what is fruitful in these divisions, to receive precisely the positive element from this diversity, in the hope that finally the division will cease to be a division at all and is merely a polarity without opposition, end of quote. And that polarity without opposition image, he is referencing Johann Adam Mohler there. All the more is this the case when he turns to reflect on what this might actually mean in practice. Again, I quote, "Hence, it would therefore be a question of continually learning afresh from the other as other, while respecting his or her otherness," end of quote. And again, touching on a similar theme in his 1995 essay on the ecumenical situation, he even notes that this need to attend to what can be learnt from the other, needs to take priority over insistently seeking to teach the other. That's very important for us to hear, and it's not the order of priorities which we tend to default to in Catholicism. Equally, for all this remarkable resonance with the core principle of receptive ecumenism, we do not find in the writings of Joseph Ratzinger, or indeed in the papacy of Pope Benedict XVI, many, if any, examples of these principles actually being turned into an intentional, practical strategy for receptive ecclesial renewal, any more than we find them turned into practical implementation and strategy either in the Vatican II texts themselves or indeed in the papacy of Pope John Paul II for all his remarkable prophetic statements in Ut Unum Sint. The call to transformative Catholic learning through receptive ecumenical engagement here remains, if you like, a work of creative, even prophetic composition, but not yet lively performance. Indeed, we might even say that throughout the papacies of John Paul II and Benedict XVI, the tendency was for these internal tensions within Catholicism to be somewhat suppressed or at least overlooked, with emphasis instead being placed on the Church's external challenges, and for good reason, and the need for internal discipline and unity if these external challenges are effectively to be met. The election of Pope Francis and his words and initiatives have, in this context, by contrast, removed any taint of disloyalty from the recognition that the time has come for we in the Catholic Church to put our own house in order, ad intra, if we are to speak and witness with any credibility, ad extra. A line, indeed, that Cardinal, His Eminence Cardinal Schönborn has underlined very strongly. That this time of Catholic conversion might also be pursued, that this time of Catholic conversion, that is the time that we are living through and being invited, not just invited, we are being called by the Holy Father to embrace this time. This time, the fuse has been running for 50 years. That this time of Catholic conversion might also be pursued via the way of receptive ecumenism is itself suggested by Pope Francis's own words, both in various sections of Evangelii Gaudium, particularly draw your attention to section 246, talking about what Roman Catholicism can learn about collegiality from the Orthodox traditions, and also by his Wednesday morning exhortation during this year's Octave of Prayer for Christian Unity, when he said, and I quote at some length, "It is good to acknowledge the grace with which God blesses us, and even more so to find in other Christians something of which we are in need, something that we can receive as a gift from our brothers and sisters." The Canadian group that prepared the prayers for this week of prayer has not invited the communities to think about what they can give their Christian neighbours, but has exhorted them to meet to understand what all can receive from time to time from the others. This requires something more. It requires much prayer, humility, reflection, and constant conversion. Let us go forward on this path, praying for the unity of Christians, so that this scandal may cease and be no longer with us. So, end of quote. If receptive ecumenism, in joint accord with Blessed Pope John Paul II and His Holiness Benedict XVI, helps us to read Unitatis Redintegratio aright, and helps us to read it aright relative to the ecumenical and ecclesial moment in which we now find ourselves, then it is in turn to be urgently hoped that His Holiness Pope Francis will now help Catholicism to live it aright for the trifold sake of the health of Catholicism in the first instance and our greater flourishing, for the furthering of the ecumenical journey in the second instance, and for the quality of our witness to the world in both act and ecclesial reality in the third instance. Thank you for your attention.